This is why I don't want to have any cakes. I'm nervous.
Are you nervous?
Of course. There's all these people here. After this, I'll have all of the cake.
Right. I don't know how this works now. I'm just going to be asked questions or we're going to be in conversation for a bit. I think the plan is that we'll do this for like about 20 minutes, half an hour, and then there'll be questions, Q&A, if you've got them, and then more gathering or going or whatever. And then we're sort of sorted, I think. And the idea is that I'll edit this and it'll be another podcast. Okay. So I'll make that available as well to you. Awesome. Is that okay?
Yeah.
That's a thing to do. Oh, let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. I should say too that I'm really honored to be here and really excited to be here. I think the book is exciting. I think the analysis is really profound. I haven't even been able to work with it enough myself yet. I have to go back and read it again for my own purposes. And if you don't follow Richard's work, although I presume most of you do, he is a prolific and fantastic theorist and writer whose work is, I think, absolutely essential for understanding the state that we are in the university, but also outside as human beings. So he will not like me saying that, I'm sure, but there we have it.
I haven't left the room, though. I've stayed.
And I feel very strongly about that. So we sort of talked through a few different questions, and we're going to go through some terms, which I think are really important, because one of the things that we've talked a lot about is some of the language in the book and in Marxist analysis of this type is very difficult. And so there were a few terms I wanted to try to highlight so that we could use them. Talk about the nature of this analysis and why it's a bit different from other ones. The focus on alienation as a way of thinking about how the public education is subsumed under the law of value, which is something else we'll talk about. And think about how this relates to practice, which I know is something that everyone in this room is really keen on doing. So to begin, we don't have any Nerf balls that you can throw at us, or please don't throw cake at us, but if you don't understand a word, we would like you to raise your hand or give a shout and say, can you please just define that again in a different language? But I do want to start with words, and one of the first set of words I think are really important about understanding the state of the academy under capitalists' domination. You talk about social metabolic control, which I think is very important to this book, and I wondered if you might say a bit about what that is to you.
Well, I suppose a starting point for this, there's lots of images, right, that are flashing up, and some of those are taken from protests and demos and things that I've been on with some lovely people in the room, including Mark, for instance, where we have been for a while thinking about the way in which the university is no longer, it was never really exempt from crisis. It was never really exempt from being repurposed under capitalist social relations. It was never really outside of that need to generate skills, capabilities for the economy. However, post the kind of Brown Review, certainly in this country, and then post the coalition, after the coalition's imposition of, or its trebling of student fees, and then changing the way in which the loans were handled, and changing the conception through policy or secondary policy, and also then primary legislation through the 2015 Higher Education and Research Act, changing the way in which universities had become effectively competing businesses, more explicitly competing businesses. It then becomes revealed to those, or it begins to become revealed to those inside the university, about how their work, their labour, is folded inside the way in which capitalism reproduces itself as a system globally. Previously, we could kind of sit back on a kind of, oh, this is about the public good. This is about knowledge exchange. This is about our social engagement. It's something more human. But in that moment where we've got students being kettled on Westminster Bridge in sub-zero temperatures, or where we've got students demonstrating, or we've got staff pushing back, all of a sudden gets, and when we begin to question why that is, we begin to think about, well, how is our work then, how is that now mediated by the market? How is it mediated by money? How is it mediated by private property? How is it mediated by an explicit division of labour which forces us into a hierarchy of professors, readers, lecturers, precarious staff, part-time hourly paid lecturers? How that all of a sudden that gets, it's always been there, but it gets revealed. And in that moment of revelation, we begin to think about, well then, how do we relate to the world as academics? How do we relate to each other as academics? How does academia relate to the world? And all of a sudden, I guess it becomes, when I'm thinking about social metabolic control, I'm thinking about our work as part of a broader global metabolism. How are we folded socially? Because our work is created socially. It's my work as a professor is related to other professors in other universities. It's related to and it's related in ways around kind of teaching, around assessment, around research. So can I turn around my assessments in quick enough in comparison to other people? Can I produce those journal articles quick enough in comparison to other people? All of that kind of stuff. And so there's a way in which my relationship to the world, to nature, my relationship to my other academics, my relationship to other people in other jobs that are notionally public sector or in the private sector, that is mediated through money, through the market, through the division of labour, through private property, through the fact that I have to create commodities all of a sudden. So this idea of social metabolic control really is about my relationship to the world, and the fact that actually the control is not mine, it's imposed on me from outside of the institution. It's imposed on me because I have to commodify my work. I have to create things that can be sold and exchanged. And in this, those who kind of effectively are driving this, they have limited control as well, because their work is being conditioned by hedge funds or finance capital, or it's being pivoted around the need to drive value for money, for instance. And that value for money is then being driven again in kind of equity markets. So that this idea of social metabolic control is like really important, I think, because it's about that relationship between the individual academic and her networks and the world. So actually, how are we reproducing the world? What is our metabolic relationship? Because it's metabolic because the argument is that the system we're in is a living entity with a circulatory system. So commodities circulate, so labor circulates, so labor power circulate, books circulate, knowledge circulates. And it does that in order that it can generate wealth, it can generate excess, it can generate surplus. So the idea there is that actually all of a sudden, in this moment of crisis, all of this becomes apparent. I'm not sure I answered the question there. I wanted to kind of introduce some of the concepts, you know.
You answered my question. I don't know if anyone else had the same question. I'm thinking about the name of your first chapter, which is Awakenings. So it seems to me like this idea. So I think the analysis in the book does lay bare to people that don't already know or haven't already accepted that we are this part of a capitalist machine in terms of the university that is also relational, and that everywhere we are being separated from this relationality. And it does, I think, lead really nicely onto the question I had about two other terms, which was you have these two terms, one of which is Weltschmerz, and one of which is indignation. And it seems to me that being awakened to this reality, which is not the reality that most of us want to believe that we're in or want to be in, these seem like two very different ways of responding to that. Weltschmerz being one, which takes us down the path of demobilization and depoliticization, potentially indignation, which potentially leads to the other. And I wonder if you would agree with that or not.
Mm. It's part of I see the whole thing as part of a process. So the book starts with this idea of awakenings and effectively argues that we're in a moment where, and I was trying to connect to that idea of kind of hashtag stay woke. So some of the stuff that was coming out of the kind of Black Lives Matters movement, not in order to co-opt it, but to point towards it, to say that actually some of the things that are being felt in that space and some of the things that are being exhibited in that space and some of the ways in which communities that have been made marginal, they've been deliberately made marginal inside a system, have responded to that when their level of brutality has got to a particular level. My argument is that actually there are things that we can kind of connect with there, and that this idea of awakenings is really important, because I think for a long time, academics, you know, when I was on demos or protests or some of this stuff, you would see the same faces and it would be a marginal number of people. It wouldn't, as a proportion of the number of academics in the country or globally or students, it's a very low fraction. However, more and more people are feeling the pain of precarious labor, of precarious work, of proletarianization of their work, of the content of their work being stripped out so that their work is becoming more narrowed down, new workload management, performance management, and that's across the kind of sector. That once that gets kind of revealed, there's a moment in which you hope that people become awakened to their own position and that they might therefore be able to move or organize for something different. So the whole idea of awakenings was really important for me in order to be able to point towards association, because the book ends really by arguing, I guess, for seeing protest and seeing the possibility for autonomy and doing something different operating across a social terrain. You don't solve those problems inside the university on its own. You absolutely cannot solve them. They operate at the level of society. You do not solve climate change or 2-degree temperature rise or ocean acidification or the politics of austerity or any of that does not get solved inside the university alone. It is an impossibility. So for me, the idea was, well, actually, how do we build then a politics of alliance more broadly in order that our social labour that happens inside the university connects with the social labour of other people outside, people who are fighting for an NHS reinstatement bill, people who are fighting for welfare, people who are fighting for mental health services for young people who are struggling, whatever it might be. How do we build a kind of politics of alliance in there? So for me, the moment of awakenings is really interesting, but I think in order to get to that point, certainly, and this might be because it's autobiographical for me, I'm very clear in the acknowledgements that that I can't disentangle my life from this. I absolutely can't disentangle my life and the work I've done on my life from this. So for me, there's a position of hopelessness that I've discussed quite a lot with Klaus in various spaces, and I can never pronounce Weltschmerz.
Brilliant.
Awesome.
You've done it.
And I got it wrong then.
And your understanding of the meaning?
Weltschmerz,
yeah.
It comes out of German philosophy, I suppose, and it's that sense of grief, pain at the state of things.
Which I feel, I see, right? So, and I think for me, there's a sense of in that chapter, because Marx talks about, in his early works, Marx talks about alienation emerging, and obviously there's a lineage here through from Hegel's work and then Feuerbach, and there's a lineage through to Marx, and Marx talks in particular in the economic and philosophical manuscripts and in the German ideology, both from 1844 and 1846. He talks about the way, effectively, there's two halves in this. There's the political economics of the fact that you have to go in order to be able to live, in order to be able to put food on the table and pay your mortgage, pay your rent, you have to sell yourself every day in an ongoing way in the market. You have to return to sell your labour power, and your labour power is the only thing you have. Your labour power is really important because it adds value. It's the only thing that adds value into commodities. So on the one hand, you have to sell your, and in order to do that, then your labor power as a thing, the thing that you can transfer from yourself to an item, to a book, to a journal article, to your ability to assess, that's just within the institution, that then you have to sell that on a daily basis in order, in a specific set of ways, in order to be able to kind to get a return on that, which is your wage. In so doing, you effectively sell your, so on the one hand, you're selling the activity of going to work, you're selling that activity, but on the other hand, you're selling bits of yourself in that moment, because you're commodifying yourself. You're saying that this isn't my true essence, this isn't the true sense of who I want to be. On the other half, there's a deeply humanist side to this. This isn't who I want to be. I might want to be something else. We might kid ourselves that we always wanted to grow up to be teachers, fire people, whatever it is, you know, marine biologists, whatever. But actually, through all sorts of ways, we're kind of funneled into that space. I'm not saying that it isn't fulfilling in some way, but that also divorces us from our community. And it's that process of, hello, how are you? This, as Mark said earlier, is a kind of group therapy session for alienated academics. So it's kind of lovely to see you. Have you got seats? You could come. Okay. So we get divorced. Well, I don't know whether I'll cut that out of the podcast or not. I don't know. I might leave that in. So we get divorced both from the activity of work, but we're also divorced from the products of work, because, like, you'll see in the book, right? In terms of who owns that, I have no say over the fact that it's cost 70 quid. I mean, I could have taken it to an open access publisher, but then would I have, you know, a couple of line managers are in the room. I don't know how they would have, maybe they'd have been cool with that. But if I'm an early career researcher, if I'm early on in my career, is that appropriate? I don't know. In some institutions, it's not appropriate. It's inappropriate. You need to be publishing in university presses or wherever it is. And that then, so you're divorced from the products, you're divorced from the activity, you're divorced from yourself in the process, but you're also divorced from your networks, because we're in competition with each other. I'm in competition with other professors. I mean, we're in competition with other institutions for students. Our sector is in competition with other sectors. Chinese are investing massively in theirs. So in that moment, I am going to talk about Weltschmerz any minute now. But in that moment, one of the things that comes through is you sort of think, Marx would argue, oh my God, do I own myself in that moment? And if you begin to sort of think, well, I'm divorced, I'm estranged, I'm alienated, I'm separated from what it really means to be me, and I have to keep going back and selling myself, and there are issues around the market and money and all of that, there's a hopeless position that you have to sit in. And for me, I've had to sit in that hopeless, that deeply hopeless position of, oh my God, I have no, as Joe will know, because it's a sense of, what do I do here? I have no, what power do I have? Can I make the world a better place? Can I only make the world a better place by doing these limited things in these limited spaces? I wanted more. I've got to pay a mortgage. I can see that the world's going to hell in a handcart. And you have to go through that deep, that space that's beyond ennui, that space that's kind of, oh my God, I have no power, I have no say, I can't do anything here. It is utterly hopeless. It has no hope, and it is abject. Both sides of hopeless. It has no hope, and it is abject. And what do I do in that? And for me, that's a really important, because Marx talks in that second half of the kind of the political economics and then what it is to be more human. He talks about the whole, what it is for you to be human as you, but what it is for you to be human as you in community. So that's the Weltschmerz bit, is the you. What does it mean to be you? Sit with you for a bit. Sit with hopelessness for a bit in order to decide what it is about your work and yourself and your life and your community you might want to do differently.
And indignation?
Oh yeah, indignation. Right, well, I'm always angry. It's my default setting, right? So there is a thing there, isn't there, about... It's like hilarious seeing Joe, like, just, yeah, he is. You should try going to watch Warsaw with him. Just like, so there's a thing there. I've always been taken with that, you know, that kind of eruption of protests around post-austerity, and in particular the kind of Indignata stuff in Spain, and the ways of organising in the squares and all of that. And this idea that indignation is more than just has a point, right? It's boiling point. Boiling point has a point. There's a point to it. You're not just boiling. Boiling point, and you can decide what you want to do with the point. The point is important. So for me, it's kind of, well, what are you going to do with your frustration, your ennui, your anger, your whatever it is, you know? And indignation's felt to me like, oh man, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, we need to find some ways constructively of doing something with this. It can't just be play. It can't be internal. If it's further internalized, it becomes self-hating, and it becomes depression, and it becomes I can't move anymore. If I can say I can decode the world a little bit, and I can decode this world a little bit, then it's not to say that that there's revolution tomorrow in this space, but it might be that we can do something tomorrow that nudges us in terms of how we relate to each other, in terms of how we value each other, in terms of how we value our students, in terms of how we engage with our students, in terms of the pedagogic practice we have in the classroom, in terms of how we organize outside of here, in terms of our solidarity outside of here, in terms of our engagement with histories outside of here. So for me, it's the purpose and the point of the anger. That was why indignation meant so much to me, and it still does. And I was not going to have that chapter. It was a coffee with you in Nottingham that changed things, because academics are really good, aren't they, at pulling the world to pieces and say it's all broken, the end. Really. Unless they're in kind of more applied spaces, in which case they're really good at doing it's all broken, here's a possibility, and that's lovely. And I didn't want it, because like I'm not really theoretical, I did not want the, oh well, I better just put one chapter about how we can make the world a better place. You know, I didn't want just that, right? So I just sort of thought, no, we have to have, let's have something else. I want to carry us towards the idea of autonomy. Let's carry us into that space. And indignation was, I think indignation is a way of passing through from the whole Weltschmerz position into possibility.
So let's invite this a bit further then, because one of the things you say is that, I think the series editor of the book says that this book is of value to Marxist educator activists, and I just presume that everyone in the room identifies himself in that way. But if you don't, maybe you will after today. And you say that you really, and I loved this sentence, that you want to be able to move beyond separation, beyond divorce, false binaries, and social estrangement to define an alternative form of social metabolic control. And I wanted to think about what can we do with this analysis? And I don't mean like it has to have an action. I mean like where do we go in that question with this analysis of alienation in particular, especially troubling this idea, I think, of hope and hopelessness and the binary between hope and hopelessness, which I think the theory of possibility is slightly more fruitful. Because I like the direction of thinking also that in addition to having hope, for example, that things will get better or that we can make change, that there are some things that we need to abandon hope in, and that these are harmful hopes, for example, and the grief of letting go of things that we are attached to and invested in. That may be a bit heavy for right now, you know, how is it that a certain kind of hoping trumps hate to counter the violence of separation, do you think?
It's difficult in this moment, isn't it? Brexit and all that, we're on the verge of civil war, right? Or we're in it. See how civil wars start. Trump, populism, all of that. It's quite difficult to maintain a hopeful position, I think, in amongst all of that. I take a lot of solace, I think, from like Mike's work. So if I'm thinking about what goes on in the, and that's not just Mike, but other people who are thinking about what's going on in the classroom, the classroom gives me a lot of hope. So working with the education team more closely this last year and the possibility of working with first year students, and you hear narratives and conceptions of those students, which I just simply don't buy at all. They might lack confidence, but these are willing and capable and able, and I get challenged. I got challenged yesterday massively by a group of first year education students about my conception of evidence-based teaching and learning. And there's something in the way in which you govern the space, and there's something as well in that with them about not framing things around utopias. I can get to this utopian position because what I learned from my conversations with them is that this emerges over a period of time. And I only have 24 weeks with them or whatever, but I want more time with them. Really, they probably want less with me, but I want more time with them because I get a sense that we can build something in the long term there in order to try to move beyond where we currently are. So that's one moment of hope I see, and in that I see that it's part of my role to connect them and those stories to counter narratives, to counter histories. So this afternoon I had I was talking to Jag earlier about an annual review that I had in our, for PhD in our department as well, where that was very much talking about counter narratives and counter histories with someone again who I feel was trying to find themselves in the space. So for me, my role is to try to help them, to give them hope that not that they can succeed in this space, but that they can come through to challenge this space, to do something different in this space, to break this space. And part of it for me is that sort of battle of ideas thing. It's a kind of Gramscian thing about, well, how do we move the discourse? How do we move the narrative? How do we move the stories we tell? Because we tell stories about these spaces. How do we move them to a different place? We need to move the stories about these. We need to move our histories. Audrey Waters in the States writes about the histories of the futures of education technology. What stories do we tell us about the future in terms of education technology? And I think we need to do the same thing about education. And part of that is to have hope in the fact that it isn't all commodified inside this space. And I think the way in which we do that is to connect to students, and in particular to more precariously employed staff, because they have less, because they see it. The curtains have been pulled for those people. For people like me, there's too much to lose, right? Status, intellectual capital, money, all of that. There's too much to lose. But I think that there's something there about understanding those positions. And that's one of the things in the book, is like that I'm very deliberately right, that I am writing from a white male, middle class, academic position, and I come loaded with buckets of privilege, absolutely dripping with privilege. If I go at certain spaces I go into. And Sara Ahmed will be very clear that there are doors that are open to me that are walls for her. So part of it for me is in this book is for me to try to reflect on my position in relation to those communities that have been made marginal, and to politicize myself around those queer or feminist or black positions, to try to reflect on those. Can I do something different then? Can I help those people to voice where they are without co-opting it and without trumping it and without interpreting it or any of that? That's a hopeful position, but you have to look for those positions and you have to see them as cracks and you have to drive into them. But it's difficult, isn't it? Because for a lot of us, we've got a lot to lose. So one of the things for me is, in terms of hope, is where are there spaces that we currently have that we can create more meaningful conversations about how we relate to each other, that are humanist, that are rooted in our common and shared humanity, and can we use those then to define new narratives, new ideas about where, new futures, new stories about our futures? Because those are outsourced to the boffins. The boffins will save us. All of those stories are outsourced to universities that have got professors who will find the solutions that will enable us to keep existing in this way. but they kind of won't, or they kind of haven't, or we're still on that treadmill. And that's one of the problems. But also at the same time, we forget that there's so much stuff going on outside. People do buckets of voluntary work. People do buckets of care work. People do buckets of volunteering. We have the, you know, we have people setting up autonomous centres. We have people engaging with, doing work with marginalised communities. It's going on everywhere, and the system can't commodify it. Wants to commodify it, can't commodify it. There's a way of beginning to flip the narrative and seeing those as spaces of hope. Not for when the catastrophe comes, but for potentially joining those up and joining into them to say, can we do something different? Bit of a rant, wasn't it? So I'm not sure that was an answer.
I think it was. I don't remember what the question was. But
nor do I, really. I'm good at that. You ask me, you say something, and then I just like rant for like 10 minutes. It's good, isn't it?
It does strike me that it's important that you talked about sort of also the question of the relationship between resistance and agency, and whether these are, you know, sort of who is doing this in these positions? Because one of the readers of your book, I know, had a question about sort of who takes more risk in having this indignation and acting upon it, and the importance of not individualizing this work within the university. So thinking about how that kind of collective work is actually happening.
Can't individualize it. You individualize it, you'll be eviscerated. Either you will be eviscerated, or you will be exhausted, or you cannot fight on all fronts on your own. It's why the kind of collective is so important. It's why Marx talks about direct labor and association. It's why we focus so heavily on cooperation, and we look at cooperation as a possibility. Cooperation.
We have a challenge in the university, I think, because our labor contracts are individualized.
Yeah.
So we have a real challenge in terms of figuring out how to organize that kind of cooperation within an organization.
As a professor, I'm performance managed as an individual, you know, and it is set up, and it's more than that, isn't it? Because like we're through excellence frameworks, research excellence framework, teaching excellence framework, the whole system is set up as confrontation. And if you look at what the Office for Students Consultation, the Department for Education publishes, consultation on the new regulator for higher education, the Office for Students, and it deliberately, and it says, we really want to support learning as a kind of common good. This is what we want. But then in the next breath, and on the same page, pages 8 to 9, because I've got it memorized, of that consultation, they talk about, it's all about value for money. It's about efficiency. It's about market information, about information the market can use to differentiate between courses at institutions and between institutions. So we're having enforced separation that is imposed through policy, through things like a teaching excellence framework, which wants to compare subjects and institutions. We have it imposed through a research excellence framework. We have it imposed because the Department for Education also wants to get a kind of killer metric, which is to link educational outcomes from the early years foundation stage baseline right the way through to degree level, in terms of can we profile you as an individual against your ability to carry debt and your ability to pay down that debt? And that's in the Small Business and Employment Act of 2015, Appendix 6 on education outcomes. So it's in there. It wants to link HRMC data to educational data. So it wants to map you, your data points. It wants to map us all, and your children and our godsons and all of that, and our goddaughters. It wants to map us in that way. And it enforces separation in that way. Your ability to cooperate, because they talk about collaboration, in the consultation talks about collaboration, your ability to collaborate, it's annihilated. You can't have it both ways. We're either competing because you want us to compete, or we're cooperating in order to build something better. The amount of cognitive dissonance you have to bring into the space in order to survive in the space, when you're told one thing but the reality is something else, is monumental. So we're back to the hopeless position, right? But when you can see it, well, part of the problem is when you can see it, right? It's the ones and zeros, and you've been unplugged from the matrix, haven't you? So that's part of the problem, because then what are you going to do? Go eat horrible grey goo for the rest of your life.
we've taken up half an hour. Shall we stop on that?
Yeah. Shall we, or have you got anything like really exciting to ask about, like what's my favourite purple food or something like that? That's a good question.
What is your favourite purple food?
Purple sprout and broccoli every day of the week.
Amazing.